Okay, it's nice to see you all. As many of you know, I just flew in from Kuala Lumpur this morning. Just had to teach at the global conference. We did our fourth global conference here, so I was obliged to go to their global conference in Kuala Lumpur. And the title of their conference was Transforming the Mind. So I spent all weekend talking about meditation and doing absolutely no meditation. It is difficult. So this is a real practice here, learning how to sit still and be quiet and calm. Unfortunately, that sometimes it's quite difficult for people to spend time meditating and also understand how to make that mind calm. One of the reasons I like the 9-day retreat format is it gives you sufficient time to allow the mind to become still. Sometimes in short retreats, or even just on a small meditation one evening, I feel it's, for many people, it's far too short to really appreciate how to calm the mind and also to experience some of the results of the quiet mind. But on a 9-day retreat, we've got time to experiment. And we've also got time just to begin a process, which is what meditation is. It's a process of the mind slowing down, the mind becoming more aware, and that awareness becoming more full of joy. I know one of the statements which I did here at the conference, which every now and again some other tradition or other teacher says something and you want to say, yeah, right on, I agree with that. And it was something which I will remember, because it's an important part of meditation, that you only get into samadhi, into the peace of meditation, from happiness. But not the happiness which is of excitement, not the sort of happiness you get by seeing your soccer team score a goal, or by getting a rebate from your taxes or whatever. It's a happiness which is born of letting go, the happiness which is almost like a baseline for the mind, which we move away from and thereby lose. It's almost like a natural happiness of stillness. And it's that natural happiness which is very important. It's one of the great sayings of the Buddha, that this mind is radiant, it's brilliant, it's beautiful. It's only because of, you know, what he called like defilements. But even defilements is a rather pernicious word. It's because all this stuff actually comes into our mind and sort of covers up, you know, the brilliance and the joy and the peace of the mind. So part of meditation is to uncover that radiant mind. And the idea of radiant mind is sometimes you look at somebody and they look radiant today. And the reason they look radiant is because they're happy, they've got full of energy, they're healthy, that's why they look radiant. So radiant doesn't just mean like a beautiful light, although that is part of the deeper meditations. It just means a general joy, happiness, uplift of the mind. And that's what we're trying to uncover here. And the idea, what the Buddha said, that the mind is naturally radiant, it's just covered up with all this stuff which we have to deal with in life. But here, you don't have to deal with much at all, which is why we have a great opportunity during a meditation retreat such as this of uncovering that radiant mind and making it nice and peaceful and beautiful. The other thing which was said as a comment for a recent conference which I went to was that many people, when they were talking about how to make the mind peaceful and how to be mindful and the great wisdom and great wonderful effects which come from meditation, they never really stressed the point that an important ingredient, a base, a foundation of meditation is one's restraint. It's a restraint of the mind and a restraint of the body, the restraint of speech, even a restraint of the eyes. Because that restraint is actually stilling the sensory input to the mind, which covers up the radiance. Which is why, again, on a retreat like this, we keep it so simple in our lifestyle. You know, we don't have much to do. We don't have TVs and radios in our rooms. You know, there's no much entertainment at all. And there's not too much busyness to be done. It's a very simple routine. And because of that simplicity of the lifestyle of a 9-day retreat, and we're in this compound here, we don't have to even talk to each other, we keep our silence. Because of that, the mind actually slows down and calms down. Which actually shows you what restraint is, the opposite of restraint. When you're unrestrained, all that really does, it may be fun superficially, but this agitates our mind. And we get further and further away from the radiant still mind. So the whole idea of keeping like these eight precepts, the whole idea of like keeping noble silence, the whole idea of just, you know, eating your food mindfully, doing it in the right way, you know, keeping the gentle routine of a retreat, is there to calm the mind, because not doing so agitates it. And it's also because of that, each person has to do it for themselves, so we don't have policemen on retreats like this. Sometimes I really thought we should get these security guards, you know, which we can hire very easily, you know, with big black caps, and always going around and saying, "You talked," or "You made a noise," or "You coughed." But of course, that would actually agitate people even more. So when you understand that the precepts, the rules, the routine of this retreat, is its purpose is not to control you. The purpose is to bring the mind to a state of stillness, to take away the agitation. Then one understands why we have this basic practice of virtue on a retreat. It's actually to go the opposite direction of agitation. Which is also why that sometimes we have to be very gentle with each other. Certainly that if somebody just breaks those rules and they talk or they do the wrong thing, please don't let that agitate your mind. Otherwise you're missing the point here. That's their business, that's their karma. In Buddhism we always say that we're each the owner of our karma, heir to our karma, born of our karma, live supported by our karma. But we don't own other people's karma. Theirs is their business, ours is our business. So that way that on a retreat such as this, by understanding we practice this virtue and we understand the law of karma, it's like we become little hermits in this retreat. We don't need to talk to anybody, we don't need to engage with anybody. We sit here, we close our eyes, it's as if, you know, we're in a little hut in a monastery alone with no contact with other beings. And that is not, again, to disturb us, but to allow us to calm down and settle down. Just one of our monks who just finished almost about 3.5 months or 4 months retreat. Again, he never sort of saw anybody for that time. Was just telling me just the power of just seclusion. The very fact that he wasn't seeing or speaking it to anybody for such a long time, for 4 months. That had a huge effect of just calming and stilling the mind. And also making it far more sensitive to the beings around him. Which is actually what happens when we live in a bit of seclusion. So this is why each one of you has their own little room to go to. And I'm not sure it's been said already, but you don't have to sit in this room together. You can sit in your little rooms, which is why it's like a little cell, a little cave you can sit meditation in. And sometimes people prefer it in their little rooms. Simply because that no one is watching, so you don't have this terrible idea of peer pressure. You know, who's sitting longer than me, especially if you've got a partner who's come here or a good friend. And sometimes it sometimes makes you sick to see how just well they're sitting there all day. So when you're by yourself, if there's no peer pressure or, you know, what's going on, you can just enjoy some solitude. But if you do come in here, just forget what other people are doing. You close your eyes and literally do your own thing. Because you get born alone in this world. Much of the time you're by yourself in this world, you'll die alone. You go to Nibbana alone. Or go somewhere else alone. So that's why that if we can somehow sort of get this idea of like being self-contained during this retreat, that will also help. You just takes away more business, because a lot of the business of our lives is the business of our social interactions, and you just know how difficult they can be. Sometimes you say kind words and they're misunderstood and people get angry at you, or sometimes you get angry at them and it's misunderstood, they think you're being kind. whatever happens, sometimes that, you know, it's so sticky, so troublesome. Actually, someone just remarked that's what on the conference that was Jean-Paul Sartre was saying, like suffering is living with other people. There's some deep truth to that. But here you don't have to live with anybody except for yourself. So you've only got one person to live with, that's you. So once one gets this foundation, this groundwork of virtue, a bit of solitude, of nothing much to do, of no business, no social interactions, that by itself will be a huge help to making the mind peaceful. In fact, if you live like that long enough, just the mind can't help being peaceful. Because you know, it's not what you do makes the mind peaceful. It's not really what you don't do that makes the mind peaceful. And sometimes people don't understand this. So they want to meditate, so what should I do? What are the tricks? Come on, Ajahn Brahm, tell me what to do. Should I watch my breath? How should I watch my breath? Should I count it? Should I do something else first of all? How do I do it? Now, making that little statement, it's not what you do which leads to deep meditation, it's what you don't do. So meditation is like a stopping of the doing, a sort of a letting go, a calming, a pacifying, a soothing, a relaxing. Which is why that you know that you're going in the right direction on meditation retreat when you feel more relaxed. The body feels at ease, the mind feels at ease, and you're going in the right direction. I think on one of the Friday night talks recently, I made a statement there which I heard from a professor at Stanford University who was investigating the results or the effects of meditation. And being a professor, he had to have a lot of people meditating for one day, like a one-day meditation retreat. But to ascertain the effects of their meditation, he had to have a control group. And have a control group doing nothing, that wouldn't really work. Instead, he sent the control group at the university's expense to a spa for the day. And when they got back, he compared the relaxation of those who were on a meditation one-day workshop and those who went to a spa. And the result was very, very clear. Those people who went to the spa were far more relaxed than those who had gone to one-day meditation. And I can understand that because people just don't know how to meditate. And they meditate there, they get even more tense. But here, this is different. Because hopefully you get the idea of what meditation is. And you can get more relaxed than going to a spa. And the reason you do that, because going to a spa, the reason why you get relaxed going to a spa is you've got these very pleasurable feelings in the body all day, whether it's in this water apparently. I've never been in a spa. Water actually. Actually, sometimes they put me up in these hotels. Not this time, I was in a monastery. But sometimes you go to these functions, they put you up in these hotels. And it's terrible, it's so much torture for me, because you can see all this stuff which you can't use. So I've seen these spa baths, I never got inside, I wouldn't know what to, how to turn them on anyway. But apparently, you know, you've got your physical body stimulated with these beautiful, pleasant feelings. Or apparently you go to a massage and people are always, you know, stimulating your body. And I think one of the reasons why this becomes calming for people is because it's a basic body awareness. Now you're actually in the moment, because it's pleasant, in the body, you're in the moment, you don't have to think about anything, you don't have to do anything because people or the water's doing it for you. And so it has a combination of like basic bodily awareness, feelings of the muscles or bones or whatever, or the skin of your body, in the moment, and it's pleasant, and therefore you calm down. Now this is an important lesson to be learnt there. Number one, when you're meditating, please sit comfortably. Don't try and force the body into a position where it gets aching, even into pain. Obviously, wherever you put your body, even the spa, imagine it's the water's a bit too hot, a bit too cold, or too fast, or whatever. There's always some complaints, but you try and get the very best for your body, which is why you can sit in the chairs, or you can sort of have some more cushions, or get the pillows out, or whatever you want to do, to try and get this body just nice. and then a little bit of body awareness. And feel the sensations in the body. And this is something which you can do at all times during this meditation retreat, a little bit of body awareness, either sweeping the body. I'm not quite sure if Venerable Kemavara has been teaching this, but I think he has, good. That little basic body awareness, feeling the body, brings you into this moment. It calms and relaxes the body. So at least you get to the spa level of samadhi. It centers you. But of course, we want to go far deeper than that. And the way to go far deeper than that is that once we understand we're in this moment and we're actually not doing anything, we're relaxing. Now if you can imagine that with your mind, just almost like giving your mind a spa bath, just relaxing it, calming it, soothing it, you understand that it's by not agitating this mind, by not doing it, not asking anything of it, not controlling it, not forcing it, not criticizing it, not, you can actually, praising it is something which is not that bad. It's a learning how to sort of calm everything down. And of course there's a big danger in calming the mind down, but I don't really think it's a danger. I think it's just part of the whole process, and that is you fall asleep. But for all the years which I've been teaching meditation, you know, sometimes as a young monk I was so afraid of falling asleep when I was meditating, you know, because I did actually go to one of the Zen monasteries in the north of England. It was a Soto tradition monastery where they use the stick, and there's this big sort of bamboo stick, and everybody said that if you get hit by this it doesn't hurt. I didn't believe it. I could visualize it even today. This must be 40 years ago now. Just the guy sitting next to me got whacked. My goodness, it was like a Sunday morning. I was just a student. It was a Sunday morning and it was really cold in the north of England. I think it was about November, December time. And it was really cold, so we were all rugged up. And it was about 5 o'clock in the morning. A Sunday morning, sort of, most of you, it's almost just conditioned into you, brainwashed in. Sunday morning is when you sleep in. So that was part of the conditioning there, so we're all really sleepy. But I was so lucky. I've always been very fortunate in my Buddhist practice. My good fortune is that somebody was more sleepy than I was. And because there was somebody who was nodding more than I was, he got hit first. But as soon as he got hit first, my back was so straight. And I wasn't sleepy at all. I was terrified. And of course, that never really did anything for your meditation, because it just made you more tired, more afraid. And it was wonderful to learn what meditation is. A lot of times through trial and error as a monk, but one of the things I'm so strong on now is allowing people to go to sleep in their meditation if that's what happens. It's a good sign. It means you're starting to let go, you're starting to relax, you're starting to stop this controlling of your mind and body, and allowing the process of meditation to happen. And it's allowing it to happen. It's not what you do, it's what you don't do. So you're not controlling, you're not criticizing. You know, the reason a person falls asleep in meditation is because they're tired. It's obvious. I remember that in those early years in Thailand, when we would get up at 3 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, we'd sit, you know, for a couple of hours every morning. And you know, this was in a hot tropical forest. For those of you who've been to these monasteries in Thailand, they've been very well developed now. They weren't like that when I was a young monk. You know, the trees and the forest was far thicker. The mosquitoes were bigger. Maybe that's an exaggeration. They're probably the same size. But it was very oppressive. So, you know, up early in the morning, it's very oppressive, you know, heat, and, you know, you're also malnourished. You know, we didn't have sort of all that good food. And so because of those factors there, afterwards I look back and see, gee, anybody, and even a Buddha would be sleepy in the morning with that sort of conditioning. So understanding that, I realized it wasn't my fault. It was just nature. When I realized it wasn't my fault, and it's nature, how on earth do you think you can control nature? You just have to accept nature and learn to be with nature and be calm with nature, because the more you fight nature, the more tense you get and the further you get away from the beautiful relaxation. So just let these things be. And this is actually where you put the mindfulness, or where you put the effort in meditation. It's the effort of restraint. But what you're restraining is this little thing inside of you which just wants to control and make it happen and do this and achieve that and get something. It's what we call attachment. That's what we're restraining. It's what we call controlling, craving. That's what we're restraining. So we're feeling sleepy. And for most people, when you feel sleepy, you think, I don't want to feel sleepy, what am I going to do about this? And if you see that sort of mind state come up, that sort of thought, that's what you're supposed to stop. Not the sleepiness, but the reaction to the sleepiness. And the negativity, I don't want this, it should be something else. And so often, actually not so often, all the time I found, if I just allow the mind to be sleepy, and I have enough mindfulness there to really put my attention, not so much on the fact that I'm sleepy, but what am I doing about this? What's my reaction? Am I really sort of letting this be? Or am I getting involved and controlling it, wanting it to be different, getting embarrassed, or not realizing its nature? If I think it's me, you know the great Buddhist teaching of non-self, it's not you, it's not your fault, nothing to do with you. Now that's the most wonderful teaching of Buddhism to understand. It's not my fault. Isn't that great to understand? I can be completely sort of free of all this guilt and fear and praise and blame. Nothing to do with me, it's just nature, it's just conditioning. There's actually, I don't know if they've seen it at Nolamara on the weekend, but there's a new book of mine out. It's the first time I've seen it, because I think it was one story, plus a couple of the monks took a lot of the talks which I'd given over a while. And first of all, they gave it to me to edit. But I said, this is terrible, you can't print this, because I'm far too critical of my own talks. So I said, no, you just go and do it. So they just went and did it, and it's just been printed over in Kuala Lumpur. I saw quite a few copies over there. And it's one of the talks they put in that book is the talk which I gave, Why I Tell City Jokes. That's the title of the talk. I gave that talk at our monastery many years ago. And the reason I tell silly jokes, I say, is because my father told silly jokes. So he brainwashed me for sort of 16 years. Or maybe it's because it's in his genes, but like, I can't do anything about it. It's just my nature. So I don't think I'm such a great joker. I don't think I'm terrible because I make jokes. It's just who I am. It's just a nature. So why can't you just let it be and enjoy it? Same, you might be sleepy. That's just who you are. Isn't it wonderful, non-self? It means you don't have to worry about it. So you're tired. It's just cause and effect has happened, has made you tired. So allow it to be, instead of fighting it. What you're trying to fight, if anything, is to fight those reactions. I don't want to be tired. I want to be bright. Look, I paid a lot of money for this retreat. I want to be enlightened by the end of it. Come on. But if you take that tiredness, which is part of the meditation practice, allow it to be, it soon disappears. And that's the one amazing insights you have. The more you fight that tiredness, the more it's going to come back and bite you. You don't fight these things, you leave them alone. And that's the way they heal. It's this beautiful Buddhist teaching of non-violence. And sometimes people just don't understand how proactive non-violence is and how it does a huge positive effect, because sometimes people think non-violence is just copping out and not doing your duty. It's a whose duty? This idea of a self who thinks it can control and influence the world. In this meditation retreat, you've got to be non-violent. Non-violent to your mind as it is in this moment. to be gentle to it, not make war with it and think, you know, I've got to get rid of this tired mind. Once you go through the tiredness, which is usually the first few days of the meditation, it comes up afterwards as well, because there's all sorts of causes and effects. It might be the weather, it might be your bodily rhythms, it might be all sorts of things come up. But if it comes up, just know it and be peaceful with it, and don't try and get rid of the tiredness, try and get rid of the reactions to your tiredness. Be careful there, because then you have to get rid of getting rid of the reactions, and it gets really complicated. You know what your mind is like. The idea is you just leave things alone. As the Buddha said, and this is a powerful teaching, the reason it's powerful because this is basic. But people keep on forgetting this. Basic teaching of the Buddha was Eightfold Path. And factor number two of the Eightfold Path, this is core Buddhism, which people really forget, was right intention. Intention is this, where you are, how the mind is moving, what's it moving towards, or how is it moving. And the right intention, there are three right intentions. And they are the intention of letting go, the intention of kindness, and the intention of non-violence, ahimsa, otherwise I call it gentleness, to make it more positive. So this is an important part of the Eightfold Path, which leads to peace, enlightenment, freedom. So when I remember that, sometimes I think, gee, I'm not doing right intention when I'm meditating. I'm fighting the mind. I'm being violent to it. I'm not being kind to myself. You stupid monk, you should be, you know, I've been in this, I just came back this afternoon, I've been here 2 or 3 hours, I should be in jhana by now. That's not being kind to your mind. That's actually being demanding and forceful. And you let things go. See how much you can let go. But what you're really letting go of is this controller. That is enemy number one. Craving, attachments, wanting something. When one learns how to do this, one is just gentle. So one goes through the tiredness. And it happens by itself. The more you let it go, the more you relax with it, the more you're at peace with it, the more you go, you know, to the spa bath. People don't fall asleep in the spa bath. But once you've had your rest, the mind brightens up. And you don't feel so sleepy. So when you actually put the focus in your reaction to sleepiness, after a while the sleepiness disappears. Because you're being letting go, you're being kind, you're being gentle. And there's a process there, which I'm sure I'm going to talk about many times, which starts the mindfulness growing in strength. One of the things which I've noticed going to all these conferences, these days in the West, mostly because of Western psychologists, especially these professors at university, even actually I just heard on Saturday, but there is that. You can get a PhD now from Oxford in mindfulness. That's no joke. You get Oxford University has started a department of mindfulness studies, and you can get your PhD in mindfulness. The guy was saying, because the British government, like all governments, know that people are just so stressed out in this world, and it's a huge problem, both for health and psychological well-being. So that, you know, the government is paying these universities to investigate things like mindfulness. And mindfulness is a buzzword now in psychology. But again, so many of those people haven't got a clue what mindfulness actually is. They've got these definitions from John Kabat-Zinn, which just misses far, far too much. And here, hopefully, that many of you on this retreat will understand that mindfulness has so many different levels. And actually, how you empower mindfulness, how you make it really strong and penetrating, and then you can understand how it can really, really work, is by being still. By not controlling it, not agitating the mind, by doing things like letting go, kindness and gentleness, you can see those calm things down. They make things still. They're calming. Often gives a simile of like you've got a kid in bed at night, they can't go to sleep. How do you get a young child to go to sleep at night when they're afraid? You calm them. You're kind. You're gentle. The same way that you soothe a child at night is the same way you soothe your crazy mind when it doesn't want to sort of meditate. You don't go to your crazy mind and say, look, shut up thinking. Stop messing around. You don't threaten your meditating mind. You're calm and kind to it. And that is how it soothes down. And as it soothes down, your mindfulness actually builds in energy. You'll see this, you'll experience this, each one of you, because you'll all calm down enough and hopefully to notice. It will be there, but sometimes we don't notice these things. Your attention, your awareness is more still, sees more, feels more. It is as if your mind is getting more powerful. Or in the words of Buddhism, you're waking up out of a sleepy state. A sleepy state is like low mindfulness. But when we're, what we think, awake, even that is still, very, very low mindfulness. But the more still you are, the less you do, the more you put the attention on this space between you and whatever you're doing, the how you're meditating, not the what you're meditating on, but how you react into this moment, and you're putting your attention there and calming that place down, then you'll find your mindfulness increases. And we get this great sort of process of meditation. As your mindfulness increases, you can actually see that space, what you're actually doing with your meditation, what you're doing with your day, how you're reacting to things. When somebody coughs, you can see just your reaction to that cough. You know, when you're tired, you can see what that happens. You know, when you have a thought, you can see how you react to it. As you get more still, your mindfulness gets far more perceptive. It's like sharpening an axe. It's like honing something, like tuning up a car. It starts to run more smoothly and see more deeply. And you get this sort of this reinforcing, this feedback mechanism. The more you see, the more mindful you are. The more mindful you are, the more you can see. And you get into the beautiful spaces of meditation. When the mindfulness gets so strong, you can actually start to see into your mind just the way you react to things. And you get, hopefully, this wonderful insight. The samadhi, the stillness of the mind, is what causes the energy of the mind. And this, I remember Ajahn Chah saying this so often. When I never, many, many years later, when I came to Australia and when I started looking at the suttas, I found it, that's in the suttas somewhere. I remember seeing it. I can't exactly remember where it is at this moment, but I remember coming across it. I said, that's what Ajahn Chah said. And it was that if you want to have a strong body, you have to exercise it. You have to move it. But if you want a strong mind, you have to keep it still. It's a different thing there. So those people who exercise their mind by thinking, doing crosswords, or doing another PhD, their mind doesn't become strong. It just gets more full of different ideas and precepts, and different ideas and concepts. But if you get a still mind, it becomes incredibly strong. Your mindfulness, it becomes really, really sharp. And you start to see how you work. Once you get to that start of, not fully powerful mindfulness, the mindfulness starts to increase. Of course, then your meditation gets much, much easier. Because you actually see what you're doing. The beginning part of meditation is basically the first couple of days is a bit of a waste of time. That's why I wasn't really all that fussed about going over to Kuala Lumpur and just leaving you in the hands of a very, very good monk. Because even if you were with the Buddha, the first couple of days is a waste of time. You're just settling in and your mindfulness is starting to sort of wake up. And this is the middle part and the end part. That's the juicy one. Because actually your mindfulness is starting to get strong. You get very perceptive. You can start to see what's going on. And then you can really mess around with your mind and get into wonderful states. But remember that how it all happens, and if that's the only insight you get here, brilliant. You see that the way to meditate is you don't control the object of your meditation. You control, if you like, the way you're looking at it by leaving things alone. Another framework, which again I use these Buddhist concepts and just adapt them slightly. Another framework which really helps is the law of karma. What you're experiencing in this very moment, right now, comes from a cause. Or actually, a multiple of causes. And that's not you. It's all come about, many, many things have created this sleepiness, this tiredness, or this jhana, or whatever, in this moment, the good or the bad, or in between. It's all come around from causes, and it's got nothing at all to do with you. I don't see why people feel, you know, that they're achieving something in meditation, or they're failing in meditation, or they're a good meditator. Well, that has nothing to do with you. The more that you get involved with this, the more you're stuffing yourself up, and the more you're going to have problems in the meditation, and the more it'd be better if you were in a spa rather than here if you get involved, because you just get sort of tense again. But if you look at this moment, whatever it is, you're tired, you're agitated, you're restless, and look upon it, this is cause, this is nature, here it is. I can't stop this, I can't get rid of it. All I can do is to make peace with it. This moment is a result of past karma. The job now is, what karma am I doing right now with this moment? Have I got unwholesome karma, like greed, hatred and delusion, to this moment? You know what greed is? Yeah, it's getting peaceful, I want more. I'm getting mindful. Yeah, next page please. And I've got a nimitta, please, yeah, and the next one please. That greediness to the meditation is a defilement. It means whatever you're experiencing right now, you're going to have bad meditations coming soon. Because you're making bad karma. If you've got ill will, and it's not talking about ill will towards somebody, I'm talking about ill will towards your mind. You know what it's like sometimes, come on, just 3 days already and still sort of going backwards, this is hopeless, come on, get yourself together, me. So, you know, you fall asleep, what time did you get up this morning? How many of you slept in? You think, oh gee, come on. And when you do things like that, you're getting ill will towards this moment, and of course that's going to create bad meditation karma. And now you understand why your meditation doesn't succeed sometimes. Or you've got delusion, you haven't got a clue what's going on. Or you actually, you don't know how the whole thing works, you don't know the rules of the game. And this is my job, to teach you those rules of the game. And of course you won't believe me, but you'll experiment and you'll find out that these actually are how the mind works. And when actually you understand how the mind works, there's no delusion anymore, no stupidity. So whatever you're experiencing right now, look, okay, this is a result of past karma. What am I doing about it? And this is where you act. This is the important, this is the cutting edge of meditation, the coal face. What am I doing with this? With my agitation, with my restlessness, with my thought, with my fantasies, with my sleepiness, or with my bliss, with the great insights which are flowing in, I'm getting enlightened, forget about that, what are you doing with that? Because if you get these beautiful enlightened thoughts, and you sort of go attaching, oh I'm enlightened now, aren't I great, aren't I wonderful, then that is the problem, your reaction to these experiences. So when you actually see that beautiful point of meditation, that is where right effort should be focused. And it's the effort to restrain. Shh, stop it. Let go. Be kind. Be gentle. And then you're making good meditation karma. And that is all you can do to create the causes. By making peace in this moment with whatever you experience. Whether you're in a jhana, whether you're seeing the Buddha in all his glory, whether you've got demons come up in your mind in meditation. Just make peace with it. Allow it to be. Demon, if you want to take over my mind, this is a Catholic place, if the devil comes up and says, I've come to take over your mind or your soul, I say, yeah, you can have it, it's not mine. whatever it is, you just let go, whatever happens, you're making peace with this moment. You're looking at this moment, and this is where we end. You can't do that at first. This is actually the high meditations, when the mindfulness is strong enough to actually perceive that moment and see what you're up to. When you get into deeper meditations, it's amazing just how this sneaky mind, or this sneaky controller called craving, can just get in there and just do some subtle destructive work. It's amazing just how you just cannot just let go. How you always have to get involved there and mess up the path of meditation. It doesn't matter, because later on your mindfulness becomes so sharp. When you get very, very still, you start to see just how you really react, and how you control the deeper stages of the meditation, and that is why it doesn't work. But it is a natural process. So the deeper you go, the more mindfulness you will have, the more sharp it will become, and it needs to be sharp at those stages, because the defilements, the cravings, the attachments become really subtle. But the mindfulness can keep up with them and can cut them off, and therefore you go deeper and get to the next layer of defilements. But the mindfulness is strong, it gets stronger as deeper as it gets, and you can cut those defilements off as well. You start to see the root ones, the ones which really stop you from being free. And this is what the path of meditation is, and it is enormous fun. Not only do you have the feeling of strong mindfulness, which is a great to experience. You know, it is an altered state of consciousness, which is one of the reasons why people come here, because it's nice, it's weird, it's interesting to, you know, to actually be really aware. And it's also, you know, it does feed your ego in the sense that, yeah, something's happening. It's not just sitting here like normal. You do feel different. But also you get to these great states of happiness as well. You feel free, you feel relaxed, far more so than the spa bath. And you start to get very, very alert and awake. And sometimes you can sit on your cushion there, you can sit for hours, when you never meditated for more than 30 minutes before. And there you are, 3 or 4 hours. Wow! And you don't do it. It just happens. So all those who think, you say, yeah, I want to do this. This is my goal. I do a 3-hour meditation in this retreat. That's stupid. You haven't understood a word of what I'm saying if you think like that. It all has to be a natural process. It just happens when you get out of the way. So you don't meditate. You watch and put the attention between you and what you're experiencing, whether it's fantasies, whether it's thought, whether it's bliss, whether you're watching the breath or whatever. And make sure that you are let go, you're kind, you're gentle, and you just allow the process to happen. You're making good meditation karma in this moment, not bad. And then you are creating the causes. That is the right effort. Once those causes build and build and build and build and build, it's only a matter of time. When the mind gets so peaceful, you understand, yeah, this is how we meditate. If you use force, if you try, you do get quick results, but not very deep. If you really want to go for the deep stuff, and this is so important, it's not the superficial meditations, this is the real, real stuff. You have to learn how to let go. That's all I've been talking about. You know you're letting go. You feel peaceful, you feel good, you feel wonderful, you're alert, you're waking up. And that is what the Buddha means. From the Pali word bujjhati, to wake up. So that's really being awake. When you really see so deeply with incredibly powerful mindfulness. So that's actually how it all works. When you can see what's going on, it's not all that hard. And I'll finish off with one of my favorite quotes from the word of the Buddha, from the suttas. And I teach this once every 2 years. It's in Nyanatiloka's word of the Buddha. I teach to the novices and the anagarikas, the trainees at the monastery. once every 2 years, I sit them down and I make this point very clear to them. Almost like pound it in again and again and again. The Buddha said that this is a path without groaning. No groaning. So if you're at groaning, either sort of inside or sort of, you know, with your mouth, and you go back to your room, oh, this is too tough, this is not good, oh, then you've lost the path. This is a path without groaning. Wow, what a wonderful word that is. So it's peaceful, it's nice, it's free, it's like being in a spa bath, only much, much better. So that is how to meditate. Any questions? Yes. By relaxing. How do you actually relax the body? Say, you know, you've got a tight point sometimes. If you try and control that tight point, it gets tighter. So the same sort of mental movement which actually allows the body to relax. That's what one does to the mind. You relax with it. You open out to it. You soothe it. You calm it. You're kind to it. If you want to have a sort of an answer just in one sentence, use loving kindness, because that is something which we know what to know how to do. Especially if you've been around Buddhist temples, loving kindness metta is just so strong. You know, we talk about it all the time. It's an important part of our practice. I know most religions they talk about love, but you know, loving kindness, we put kindness on the end of it, and it's an important thing we talk about. We focus on enormously. So many of you know what that means and how to do it. You know, when it's, you know, to your enemies, the door of my heart is open to you, no matter what you've ever done, no matter what you're doing now. And that is a wonderful way of actually getting the idea of what that means, of opening the mind to this moment. So that is not a controlling. I know there are some loves which control, and maybe you've had relationships like that, you know, where they control you, but that's not really the, you know, the love of loving kindness of metta. And the metta is, you know, you probably experience that unconditional love every now and again, and it's so beautiful to have that. It just moves you. This is pure. This is a high state of mind. Now you can feel what that is, and transfer that feeling onto your meditation object or this moment. The door of my heart is open to this, whatever I'm experiencing. The door of my heart is open to my sleepiness. The door of my heart is open to my stupid mind. Now when you actually open the door of your heart there, you're restraining the controller. You're stopping it. You're stopping the craving, the attachments. You're letting go. So that's one useful way of restraint. Loving kindness. You did. The only reason you're breaking the precept is you're getting involved. There's craving going on there somewhere. You're not letting go. That's why, you know, when we get involved and start doing things, when we're here, that's when the precepts become very brittle and very easy to break. Because, you know, the precepts, the only reason we break precepts is, you know, because of ill will, selfishness, greed, you know, wanting something. Which is why that, you know, when a person becomes enlightened, it's not that they decide, I'm not going to break any precepts anymore. Gee, I'm enlightened. I've got to sort of live up to the standard and not let my mate stand who are also enlightened. It's a natural sort of purity of the mind. You know, it's just, that's what one is. A fish lives in water. You know, the fish just can't get outside of water. The same way like an arahat, an enlightened one, they just can't break precepts. It's just impossible for them. It's unnatural. They just can't do it. It's against the laws of their nature. It's not they decide to keep the precepts. They just can't do anything else. So actually when the mind just really gets very gentle and kind, you find these precepts become so natural. And you see a sort of an ant there, or a sort of, you can't do it. So that's actually what happens. Does that make sense? You had a question over here somewhere. Any other next question? Oh yeah. I always get Ralph and Clementi. When you let go, that sometimes you blank out. Fine. Allow yourself to blank out for a while. You won't blank out for too long. It's just that the mind needs to rest for a while. And just see what happens next. So remember, if you're blanking out, it doesn't matter. Just allow it to be and allow it to happen. And after a while, the mindfulness starts to get stronger. Yes, that's an amazing thing to realize, that you don't even have to ask to watch the breath. Sometimes it just comes up. That's an amazing thing in my meditation. Sometimes I think it may be because I've been conditioning myself to watching the breath after so many years of meditation. Just the mind just knows what to do, I don't tell it. But I really think that that's probably the truth of many people. Especially you've done so much breath meditation in the past, Kimenti. The mind knows what to do, just leave it alone. It's great to be able to do that. It's like having a well-trained husband. You've done the job, you've trained him very well, so you can relax now and enjoy. So it's much easier to train your mind than train a husband. So it's more important too as well. So don't worry about blanking out, yes? Okay. Okay. The ladies first. Yes, very good.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It's about this, I'm not going by particular, but it's about this eating precept.
Yeah.
You see, I started doing meditation, drinking Milo is okay, but I think Milo is not okay with...
it's a precept there.
Okay, Dr. Tsai.
Yes, okay, just the precept...
To be kind to the body, it's just only 9 days, I've been a greedy food person. I don't mind the energy drink, but I think Milo is not an optimal.
You're talking about sort of the sixth precept, which is not taking food in the afternoon. And, taking Milo or milk drinks and stuff like that. And I know that some people look at us Theravada monks and they say, you spend so much time talking about what goes in your mouth, about food. Which is it, it's our precepts, and so, we've got to respect those precepts. Also understand what the precepts are there for be kind. So as monks, we got used to this, we don't take milk in the evening, simply because Ajahn Chah told us not to. So out of respect to my teacher, the lineage, in our monastery down at Serpentine, we don't take milk or Milo in the evening. But there is enough leeway there, because I used to study those rules, and... that to the Western Sangha, I invented a term like grey areas of precepts. Because, life is never black and white. You can't make a sort of a line there and just... In law you can, but sometimes that just doesn't make any sense at all. It doesn't.
I feel so guilty.
That's the problem.
It's just automatic. To me, because at this stage, I'm carefree because I'm less sensitive.
Yeah.
Cutting down a lot.
Yeah, okay,
so,
but...
I could say gingerly, but it becomes like too much effort to change so many things.
Yes, indeed. Which is why, out of kindness, for all the retreats I've been doing here, leading here for quite a while, I allow milk drinks in the evening. So it's actually allowed here, for a 9-day retreat, to have Milo, to have milk, to put some milk in a tea or a coffee. So you have my full permission to do that. Now, the biggest problem is not the Milo, but the feeling guilty about it.
Yeah, which is ridiculous.
Yeah.
I'm
that's right, yeah. But sometimes you can see where that comes from. Sort of, it's a sense of, the I involved here and judging oneself and trying to control things. And thinking that purity will come just from... Okay, yeah. So when it does wake you up and you feel guilty, again, you don't feel guilty about being guilty. So, you don't add to it. So again, you use this wonderful method, I feel guilty. Make peace with that. Be kind to it. Be gentle to it. Open the door of your heart to the possibility you'd make mistakes. Now, that calms the whole thing down. This is beautiful, metta from a Buddha. If you went up to a Buddha and you said, no, you didn't just eat Milo, but you went outside and it had like a hungry jack hamburger. You know, because it's very easy to do here. You can just walk outside. No one will know it. At 5 o'clock, just go around the corner. There's many sort of places. You know, if you don't like Hungry Jack's, you can get some nice vegetarian food down the Vietnamese restaurants down William Street. I can tell you some of the nice ones if you really want to know. But the point is, if you did that and came up to me, you know, what I would do is say, oh, never mind, don't do it again, that's all. There would never be any punishment. It's just understanding that sometimes that's just a conditioning of our behaviours. As some people are just conditioned to be naughty. You can't stop it sometimes. But by being kind to the naughtiness, it just fades away and disappears. So it's no big deal. It's more important to actually to not eat the guilt than to eat the Milo. So Milo's okay in the afternoon, but guilt is not okay in the afternoon. Nor in the morning, nor at night time. That really is against the precepts. So yeah, the precept-wise, you can have milk drinks in the afternoon or evening. That is allowed. That's just where we just draw the compassionate line in these retreats. But you can't have Hungry Jacks or noodles or anything else, whatever you want. Yeah, so your question here?
Sometimes when I'm concentrating on the focal point, there's not enough sort of left to be watching what is going on, and so things creep in.
Yes, you say sometimes when you're focusing on the object of meditation, the focal point, you haven't got enough mindfulness left to know what's creeping in. Which is why if you have a choice between putting most of your mindfulness on the object of your mind, just say the breath. You know, the breath. You can be looking at other things. You're focusing on the breath there. I think it's more important actually to focus on that space between you and the breath, rather than the breath itself. So that's where the action is in meditation. So when I do that, the present moment comes up, silence, the breath comes up, beautiful breath. It happens naturally, because I'm really putting attention to how I'm doing things. Just like sometimes you're building. You pay attention to how you lay a brick and then how you sort of put the roof on. And after a while, just the building comes by itself. You just put attention to how you're doing it, not so much of what you're doing. So it's a how is most important.
Do you mean looking at the distance? Looking at the place from a distance?
Yeah, that's by looking at the place from a distance. Go to all these conferences, these psychologists, there's a word for that, they call it decentering. Doesn't really matter if they've got a word for it or not, it still means the same thing, but it does mean having a framework, just a way of looking. It's not a reality, it's just a framework for your perceptual cognitive processes. But, you know, you think of yourself over here, and you think of what you're experiencing, like, so there's a screen on the TV or on a movie or something. You put some distance between the observer and the observed. And then that really helps to understand is what's in between the observer and the observed. That's just one way of looking at it. It's not as if there's a soul out here and the observer's over there and there really is a physical space. It's just a useful way of perceiving just what's happening in meditation. And then it gives you the opportunity. And it's not what I'm looking at or who's doing the looking. It's nothing to do with me. It's just what's in between. Which is what the Buddha meant by it's these adventitious defilements which come up and cover the beautiful radiant mind. So it's the how in meditating. It's a great thing to realize and to see because you find out what a problem in meditation is. Many people can sit down and watch the breath, but how are you watching the breath? And those people who watch the breath with controlling and wanting, they're the ones who get tense. They'd be much better if they were at a spa bath. And after a while they give up meditating because they can't meditate, they say. They don't get anywhere. Or they get sort of angry as soon as they leave the meditation place. I always used to tell this joke. We don't do that these days, but before we'd always have a group photograph at the end of a meditation retreat. We'd always put that in a newsletter. And everyone would always be smiling because they're about to go home. And I thought that is actually being untruthful. Really, they should put the group photograph right in the middle of the retreat when there's about 3 or 4 days of pain left. And then see if they could smile. That'd be a much more representative of if they really knew what meditation was or not. So it's much better actually to do the beautiful, peaceful meditations. And then first day, second day, third day, fourth day, fifth day, sixth day, seventh day, eighth day, ninth day, you're all smiling all the time. By the ninth day, just the smiles are more beautiful. But the last hour, when you take the group photograph at the end of a retreat, everyone is miserable. Going home, yeah. Oh dear. Yes, you had a question. It's fruit. We usually just fruit fed on the other side of the line, not okay. But you can have fruit juice. So what's the difference between fruit and fruit juice? Hardly any difference. So if you have a nice juice, if you have a fruit which you really like, put it in the juice of the drink there. Brilliant. Yeah.
And there are other times when my legs are really painful and I feel quite tired. And also if I am meditating in deeply, I find that my brain feels sometimes like a bruised pumpkin.
Ah, oh, marvellous. That's a rose pumpkin limiter. No, what you just told me then, this is because of it's being recorded. That sometimes so when you meditate, you know, you feel so light and your legs don't hurt at all. And there's other times when your legs really hurt and you feel tired. Investigate those. It's telling exactly what I've just been saying, that when you really relax and let go, the body is light, the mind is light, and there's hardly any pain. And this really shows how much of physical pain actually comes from this controlled, intense mind. I've noticed that, and it's obviously true. When people meditate, sometimes pains disappear. And it's wonderful when that happens to you, but the pain doesn't disappear when you're trying to get rid of it or trying to control it. It gets worse then. But when you really relax and let go, a lot of pain is inflammations. And when you just relax and let go, the inflammation gets far, far less. So this is how you meditate. Sometimes if I'm not very peaceful, that sometimes it's hard to meditate for half an hour because you get aches and pains. I'm getting old now. But if you get into deep meditation, it always struck me, sometimes you meditate for 3 hours and you come out afterwards, not an ache, not a pain, not a stiffness at all. And sometimes you meditate for 45 minutes, you don't get into any deep meditation and you're aching and your back hurts and you're stiff. It's wonderful. It doesn't make sense. It's not logical. Surely the longer you meditate, the stiffer and the more painful you should be. But it doesn't matter about the length of time. It's what's happening in the mind is the most important. I'm not quite sure what a rose pumpkin is, but as long as it feels good. A bruised pumpkin. Does that mean like it's nice? Or bruised pumpkin? Not so nice. Not so nice, okay. But sometimes that might be, if the mind feels sort of tired or bruised, it probably is because, you've been beating it. So that's why I just, stroke the pumpkin. There, a nice pumpkin. Stroke it. And then a pumpkin will be just so nice. It'll be just like this shining pumpkin rather than a bruised one. And the reason people do feel tired is because they work so hard. So don't work so hard in meditation. Yes?
Sometimes if you've got a pain somewhere, it's very tempting to actually go into a relaxation technique very fervently.
Yeah, go for it. No, it's not controlling, it's actually learning how to let go of things. So what you're saying there, that sometimes you have a pain in the body, just say like an ache in the knee, and then you do some relaxation techniques to actually to soothe that pain. Well, that's wonderful, because the relaxation technique is exactly the same thing which you do to your mind in meditation. So you're actually developing the attitudes of mind by practicing on your body. But you know that, you know, with this body, to relax a pain in the body, you can't just say, I'm going to endure this. I'm going to beat this down. I'm stronger than this pain. Okay, we're having a contest now, pain. And I'm going to beat you down. You know, it gets worse that way. But if you soothe it and calm it down, be friends. Sometimes that's what you do. You put metta to the pain. Okay, I'm not trying to get rid of your pain. The door of my heart's open to you. You can be with me forever. You're a friend, pain. And that's wonderful when you do that. The whole thing relaxes. And maybe the pain doesn't disappear, but it just changes its texture, or it's just not a problem anymore. It's just there. And this is actually how you do it with the mind as well. So, you know, you have a restless mind, thinking all over the place. Oh, let it be. Leave it alone. Just what the brain needs to do. So that's fine with me. So you maybe think of all sorts of stuff. But when you're kind to that, it's amazing, it just disappears, and you're still. All this thinking stops, but if you try and stop the thinking, come stop thinking, come on, no more thoughts, okay? And another thought comes up, and it's endless, and you really get yourself stuffed up, and that's where you don't just bruise a pumpkin, you smash it to smithereens. So that relaxation technique which you've learned to calm and relax your body, transfer that to your mind. And then you'll find you know how to meditate. Okay, I think that's... I wasn't quick enough. Okay, I was going to say that's enough for this evening.
How do you know the boundary between being kind to yourself and being self-indulgent? Because I know, for example, I've got a certain amount of worry that that's permission about sick if you felt tired, you're going to sleep. And quite a few times I've gone.
Okay. You're saying, well, how do you know you're being self-indulgent? How do you know you're being kind? Just err on the side of kindness. Or in self-indulgent, just give in more. Especially as a Westerner, because we're such control freaks. And so, you know, it's much safer just to go and take the nap, to let go. Sometimes you will indulge. You will go a bit too far. But that's much, much better than actually going and making the error in the opposite direction. And eventually what happens towards the middle, the end of the retreat, so the mind becomes so mindful, it can see more clearly, as the mindfulness becomes stronger, the difference between indulgence and kindness. Because, you know, you don't want to go back and sleep. It's much nicer, it's more fun, meditating. So the kindness knows what's in its best interest. Because kindness wants to create happiness and goodwill, and knows what good is. So, on the side of being kind and be easy on yourself. Okay, so that's enough for tonight. Just giving you a bit of an introduction. When I come back, there'll be another talk tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock, because I'm going to go back to the usual routine. And then tomorrow evening will be the question time. So, you know the routine, as you've been here before. It is 8 o'clock, isn't it? Usual talk? Yeah, 8 o'clock after breakfast. It'll be a formal talk. And if you have any of the questions, you put them on a piece of paper in the box outside, and then I will answer them as best we can. And I did actually, where was the interview list? Have you put any more up? Okay, where do we put them on the board, in the usual place?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll put some interview sheets on there, so that when the interviews, because of coming in late here, instead of actually organising and having everybody every couple of days, and just carry on, just first come, first served, and you can put your name down, but try not to come every day, unless it's really important. Because that means that, you know, you're taking away the opportunity for others. So try and arrange it maybe every 2 days if you need it, and just put your name down there. But if it really is important, like something's coming up in your meditation, or you're really going crazy, and you just, then you can put your name down there every day, or every twice a day if you're really going crazy. But you know, try and make it every couple of days. And sometimes people just, they don't need any interview, because everything is going nice and smoothly, they're doing fine. Maybe just one interview every retreat is probably maybe all they need, just to check in. And also, if you've got specific questions, sometimes it's even better to write them on a piece of paper so it shares them with everybody, because sometimes on the retreat somebody comes in and they ask a question and give the answer, the next one comes in and asks the same question, give the same answer, and the same question comes in again. And so it would be much more productive to share that question or that problem with everybody by putting it on a piece of paper and dealing with it in the evening time. And also the last thing, that when you do come in for the interviews, please remember 10 minutes is the max, otherwise we won't bulk bill anymore. In other words, you're coming in there not to discuss your problems of your life. This is not like free counselling service, this is about, it's a meditation. So come in there and just, now 10 minutes, just, and get the question quite clear in your mind, and then, right, just average, it doesn't matter if it's 15 minutes or 5 minutes, but don't go on for 20 or 25 minutes, because that makes it difficult for others. Okay, so I think that's just enough housekeeping now. Now, I'm going to be kind to myself, because I've just come in from a busy weekend and a long aircraft trip. I'm going to go to bed. Good night.